Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, and the environment, reporting on a variety of venues, Progressive Radio, Alternet, TruthDig, EcoWatch, The Huffington Post, Intent.com, and others. For many years, I've reported on the connection between food, health, and the environment and our personal, societal, and global well-being. And every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss different facets of that with thought leaders, experts, authors, advocates, and all the people who are aware of different things that are going on in our communities, in our society, and in our world that impact our health and the health and well-being of future generations. And that's what we talk about every week on this show. If you're a regular listener, thank you so much for your support. You're probably aware that for going on about the last 2 months or more, our show has been devoted to covering Fast Track and the global trade deals. I'm also the reporter who broke the story on fracking as a news cycle reporter back in 2009 and have covered it ever since. So I'm used to talking about stuff, things going on in our world and our policy life that people may not be broadly aware of when I first begin talking about them. This happened with fracking. No one had even heard of the Halliburton loophole. And it's been happening with this issue, too. This talk about the deals, the treaties, TPP, and all the rest of it may have seemed obscure when we first began covering it about a year ago, and more intensively this winter, January, February, March, April. But now all of this has risen up to public notice because the fast tracking of these trade deals has come to the Senate and is soon poised to come to the House of Representatives for a vote. President Obama has been stepping out in various media venues to promote and persuade people to sign on to the bill. So, you know, thanks and gratitude to all the listeners who kind of hung in there with me when this was not such a in the forefront issue as it is today, this week, this month, and listened and informed themselves and were ready and prepared to know what we were talking about and to act. So I want to just thank you. And now it's all coming to a head. So thank you for your persistence. Thank you for your action. If you're new and this is the first time you're listening, you'll learn a lot today about what's going on. And you can also go into the Connect the Dots archives on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM, and you can listen to past programs. They're on a range of different topics that these treaties affect, everything from food to health to the environment. Today we're going to be talking more about the economy and our political system with returning guest Adam Weissman. Adam has been on our show before. In fact, he was on last week and was just terrific. He's a great organizer with Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, an organization addressing the threat posed by free trade agreements to animals, the environment, safe, ethical, and sustainable food, and the human rights of environmental defenders. Obviously, if you listen to the show regularly, you'll know that these are all topics of tremendous import, and it's a great organization, and he's a great organizer for connecting the dots between all of them. He also represents his organization in the Environment and Trade Justice New York Metro organization, a coalition of organizations from diverse social justice and environmental movements, and they all work together to educate us and prepare us to, you know, transform the way we handle trade and handle our economy from the NAFTA model, which has been sold and oversold, and these treaties are part of that, but they have been a dismal failure on many, many fronts, not least of which has been, you know, on our economy, on our jobs, on the middle class, and if the middle class is hurting, all those who are not even at that echelon are even having a worse time, which is where the justice issue comes in. So, you know, we're really grateful for them and their leadership in educating people about the downsides of this model. And, of course, this educational process is not happening in a backwater. It's really, you know, occurring over major media now and in Congress because a lot of people, you know, all the way up the food chain to, you know, our senators and congresspeople are also aware of the dismal record of this particular free trade model, which these deals are now attempting to, you know, give us yet another serving of to our detriment. So we'll be talking about all of that on today's show. We'll discuss some current issues in terms of where the deals are now, some recent things that are happening that are terrific and hopeful. I'll also be bringing in a bit of the press coverage and the dialogue that's taking place about all of this, which is very hopeful and positive, and it's really occurring as a revival of democracy, I would say, and it's a good thing. We really need it. And we'll also be talking about some of the economic aspects of this with Adam Weissman. It's not one of my strong suits, so I'm really grateful that he will be here to kind of orient us to, you know, what is going on and what people are talking about and protesting about the economic consequences of the proposed treaties. So welcome back, Adam Weissman.
Thank you so much for having me again, and I hope we can help to shed some more light and expose the TPP and the TTIP today.
Yes. Now, basically, TTP and TTIP, just for those who are hearing this for the first time, are the two trade deals. One, the TTP is the Pacific deal. The TTIP or TTIP is the Atlantic deal with European countries. And basically, what's happening now is that the president is asking for fast-track authority to get those rubber-stamped, his ability to sign these deals sort of preordained so that he can move ahead and sign them. You want to talk a little bit about the fast-track process just for our new listeners, Adam, and why there has been so much question, debate about it and resistance to it?
Sure. So when the way fast-track works is it will apply to really any trade negotiations that take place in the number of years covered by fast-track authority. So not only will TPP be covered and TTIP be covered, but also the Trade and Services Agreement, which is also currently being negotiated, will be covered in whatever other horrors presidents come up with in the next few years. So fast-track is a process that goes back to the 1970s. It is a process by which Congress delegates trade negotiating authority to the executive branch. The Constitution very explicitly puts international commercial agreements or regulation of international commerce in the hands of Congress. Specifically Article 1, Section 8, Clause C, the Commerce Clause, makes this very explicit. And it is something very clearly built into our system along our whole model of checks and balances and separation of power, that this is a congressional power, not an executive power. So what has happened going back, even before Fast Track, is Congress has delegated authority to manage trade policy in terms of things like setting and raising tariffs to the executive branch. There have been a few different pieces of legislation that have done that, and there's an earlier one called RTAA, the Reciprocal Tariff Agreement Act. So Fast Track wasn't the first form of delegated trade authority. Part of what makes Fast Track so extreme, though, is that, there are a couple things about it. One is that it's been used increasingly for trade agreements that have to do with far more than trade. And that really goes back to the inception of Fast Track in the 1970s when President Nixon sold the idea of Fast Track as a way to increase U.S. exports by knocking down other countries' non-tariff barriers to trade in the content of these trade agreements. Now, what is a non-tariff barrier to trade? Now, when we think about, probably when most people think about trade agreements, if they think about them at all, they imagine that these relate to things like quotas and tariffs on goods. So if you raise your quota on importing grapes, will raise our quota on imports of cheese or whatever. Or if we eliminate your quotas, we'll eliminate ours. Or if you eliminate your tariffs, we'll eliminate our tariffs on your product. So it's a way to eliminate barriers to the importation and of import and export of products in the interest of, well, countries, countries want to gain market access, so in exchange they grant market access. So that is what trade agreements have traditionally done. What Nixon argued is that we can increase exports by attacking so-called non-tariff barriers to trade. And he tried to sell that to labor at the time, which at first sounded like a good idea until people realized that those non-tariff barriers to trade were really our public interest protection laws to a substantial degree, not exclusively, but to a large degree. Those were our environmental standards, our labor rights laws, our consumer protections. These were the non-tariff barriers to trade, things like don't send our country products that cause cancer. Well, it's a barrier to trade, sure. It's keeping out a product. It's not a tariff. But these are the kind of rules that we want to be able to pass. These are the kind of rules that we would want to this is the kind of power that we want our government to maintain. And of course, it's not just a one-sided thing. We don't just get to say to other countries, you can't have laws against importing cancer-causing products, but we get to keep them. So in reality, what the fast-track model has facilitated is this push towards attacks on public interest legislation under the guise of free trade. And so the way that fast-track works is that the Congress delegates authority to the executive branch by legislation. The Congress grants this fast-track authority and in the process takes very little power over what actually the president does with that authority. So the Congress can say, these are the things we would like you to negotiate about, these are the countries we would like you to negotiate with, but the president has no obligation to actually pay attention to any of that. It's really just more of a guideline. And so maybe the president can consider it, maybe not. And so the president can then go and negotiate trade agreements with whomever the president wants, can include in those agreements whatever terms the president wants. That can mean all kinds of changes to domestic legislation to be in accordance with those trade agreements, things that really have nothing to do with trade, things like things like rules around intellectual property, things like corporate investor rights, things like all kinds of our food safety regulations. And so then Congress, having delegated that authority to the administration, is forced to vote on these agreements in a way that really turns Congress into little more than a rubber stamping agency. So what happens is the negotiation is completed. The agreements are sent to Congress. They have 60 days to vote on the agreements in the House. Then they're turned over to the Senate, who has another 30 days. In the House, in both houses, the agreements cannot be held up in committee. They cannot be amended in any way. They can't change anything about the agreements, not a letter, a comma, a period. They can't add or subtract a word. They can't. They are basically stuck with them as they are negotiated. They are sent, after going out of committee, they're sent to the floor. On the floor, they're restricted to 20 hours of debate, and that's 20 hours from stop to finish. That's not a couple hours one day, a couple hours the next. It's the clock starts ticking at 20 hours. And then so that means for each member of the House, if in theory everyone in the House wanted to speak on the floor, each member would have 88 seconds.
The bottom line is the treaties can't be discussed, they can't be changed, they can't be fine-tuned. There's not adequate debate on them, there's no public disclosure of them, and once the fast-track authority is signed, they can be changed in substance from what people were originally shown, and they can't do a darn thing about it. It's already kind of green-lighted and going forward. And if there are any amendments, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, that members of the Senate or Congress would like to add, they can't add them, but the treaties could be changed later by the multinational corporations or foreign governments. So this is a huge rights and giveaway that the treaties are kind of setting up. And further, this will be set up for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. But the other problem there is that that's not the only treaty. So it will go forward with that treaty. It will go forward with the TTIP, which we mentioned earlier, the next treaty. But the fast-track authority, once in place, continues not only for other future treaties yet to be determined, but even in the presidency of future presidents yet to be determined. So even if we, were people who felt that we should have just intrinsic trust in what the current president might be telling us, and I don't know how many people really feel that way, and what's coming out in the debate over this is not everyone feels that way. And it's really a lot to ask for anyone to place that kind of trust in an executive. But whoever are the future occupants of that seat, they too will have that same power to make decisions without change, without transparency, and without the knowledge of those who will be affected by them. So if their, economic theory is wrong, if their understanding of something is imperfect, which could be true today, tomorrow, or sometime into the future, there's no corrective present. And so that's been, a huge problem that has surfaced. And, while organizations like yours, Adam, have, and, my reporting and other organizations like Global Trade Watch and Flush the TPP and Friends of the Earth and the Sierra Club and others who've been in advance on this issue, who've been aware of it, what has been gratified as we have watched this process inch forward into the Congress, into the Senate, and into the Congress, is that we're not the only ones aware of it anymore. It's being covered in all the major media. There's tremendous, a lot of people are speaking up about it, including our own New York Senator, Charles Schumer. What are some of the objections, Adam, that people have been voicing, that have been coming, from these different quarters? What is it that people are, red flagging and concerned about? Like people, prominent people and thought leaders, publishers, editors, people writing in the press, like what are the predominant complaints, and sense of caution around this?
Well, there's a wide range of issues. The Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz has been critical of many aspects of the agreement, but one part that he's highlighted in particular is how the intellectual property rules of this agreement will threaten access to essential medicines by extending the patent life of drugs, by maintaining data exclusivity over clinical trials on medicines, by really advancing an agenda for the pharmaceutical companies to ensure that drugs never make it to generic form or the patent life until they do is extended for a great length of time, so that drugs that they are able to charge enormous prices on while they keep them under patent never become widely accessible into the far future. And so that we're not just talking about a skin cream for a rash or something. We're talking about medicines for we're talking about medications for AIDS. We're talking about medications for hepatitis. We're talking about life and death medications. He said that the potentially we could be thousands of lives could be lost as a result of the intellectual property rules being negotiated in TPP. Michael Bloomberg, someone who is certainly very positive on free trade overall, has raised real concerns about the way that the tobacco industry is using agreements like TPP to attack anti-tobacco legislation, to attack things like plain paper packaging legislation, rules that are designed to prevent the tobacco industry from hooking and enticing new consumers, have been under attack by investor cases brought by companies like Philip Morris. There have been cases against Australia, Uruguay, where Philip Morris uses its power, it uses a subsidiary in a country that has a bilateral investment treaty with a country that's passed legislation regulating tobacco. These investor treaties give corporations the right to sue government in international tribunals outside the jurisdiction of their national court system, where they can demand unlimited sums in compensation, saying that their expected future profits are being expropriated by public interest legislation. So those kind of rules are looking to be built into TPP, and while President Obama had originally promised that there would be a carve-out around tobacco to prevent the tobacco industry from using TPP in this way, that promise, as with many, was not fulfilled. So Michael Bloomberg, someone who is rarely an ally on trade policy issues, is very concerned about the tobacco industry's ability to use TPP. Some of the other people prominent people who've been at the forefront of this issue, Elizabeth Warren has been one of the strongest voices. She is, among other things, very concerned about the issues around secrecy in the TPP negotiating process. The Obama-negotiated trade agreements have been conducted with an unprecedented level of secrecy. Even if you look at the Bush-negotiated trade agreements, the public could actually see what was being negotiated. They may not like what they were seeing, but they could at least find out. The Obama administration has eliminated that defect in the process of railroading through anti-public interest trade deals. So they are treating these agreements as matters of national security. The documents are classified. Even members of Congress until very recently have had restricted access. And even now, they are sworn to secrecy on what they see. And there's been an attempt throughout this process to give Congress as little information about what's being negotiated as possible, let alone the rest of us.
Let me just interject there for a second, because there was a debate which our listeners may or may not be acquainted with. The president appeared on the Chris Matthews show and sort of laid out his argument, for the treaties, and he said that those who were questioning some of the underlying assumptions and pointing out problems in the way that you're describing, and he singled out Senator Elizabeth Warren in this regard, were just wrong. They were mistaken. Senator Warren sort of responded along with Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and they were saying, they were saying we can't debate the facts when the American public can't read the contents of what this is, and because these treaties are secret. And then the president returned and said, oh, no, they're not secret. Every member of Congress can have access to them. So I just want to pause, because I think that was kind of confusing for the general public, and just discuss that for a moment, because what happens is that when people hear it's secret, they sort of they assume, well, maybe it has to be secret for security reasons. They don't understand, that maybe what's behind that closed door contains a lot of other things that have nothing to do with security at all. So if, a president comes forward and says it has to be secret, but Congress can read it, a lot of people will take him at his word. And also, these treaties are complex. Just the range of issues that you've discussed are fairly extensive. Few people have the time or interest to drill into all of these areas. There might be one issue that particularly interests them, whether it's jobs because they're labor, or medicine prices, medication prices, as you've mentioned, the environment. I mean, there are different reasons why different people may be interested. So in a sense, when we hear their secret, it's kind of a big relief, because then I don't have to go and take time that I don't have from my busy schedule and try to kind of get to the bottom of this, because I can't get to the bottom of it anyway because it's secret. In reality, because of the global outrage in many quarters of the world about these treaties, there have been a great number of leaks. A lot is known, and a lot has been interpreted. There is quite a lot that we as ordinary people can find out, and this is what people like you and I and others who are following this closely have been doing, finding out that information, translating it to the public. But let's, pause for a moment and go back to the conversation, the debate that was occurring between the president and the senators. Members of Congress did have the access and opportunity to read the treaty, so it wasn't exactly secret from them, even though it's been withheld from the public. And But these are, you know, but what does it take for them to read it? They have to go into a locked room. There's a security guard there. The treaty itself is, I guess, thousands of pages long. It's comprised of dense legal language that would need to be, you know, carefully thought through and interpreted by attorneys. There may be areas therein that are, you know, a particular member of Congress may not be expert in. They're not allowed to take notes. They can't take a screenshot. They can't remember a sentence and go back and talk with an aide or an expert in that area. What are the ramifications of this? So, you know, having a thousands of pages of detailed legalese pass before your eyes, when you're sitting there in a locked room with a security guard, you're forbidden to discuss it. There's no way to digest it. This is not something that I would call transparency, or, gee, it's not secret, you can read it. In fact, you're reading it under tremendous duress and with a lot of obstacles to your mastering it, to your understanding it, and to your interpreting it. And these are, we're talking about Congress here now. These are the people that are supposed to interpret it for us, and there have been revelations, I think it came out on the Hill, that only about 40 members of our entire Congress, that means the Senate and the House, have actually availed themselves of this opportunity and gone to read the treaties. And we don't even know if they've read them in whole or in part, because you are not going to be able to sit down and read 1,000 pages at a single sitting. So you know, we know how busy any kind of executive might be. I mean, the same thing applies a thousandfold for any, you know, an elected official, and especially for the members of Congress. So it's very disingenuous to say they're available and, you know, they can read them and it's not a secret, when in fact this is how tightly it's being held. And the most important part of it is that even with having done all of this, the prime point is that these, our senators and our congressmen, cannot turn around and talk to us about it. They can't say, I know this provision is in it, and I'm concerned about X or Y provision. They can't talk in any specific way with their constituents about this, because, you know, it's a security issue, supposedly. And yet many of the things that you were just mentioning, Adam, are not security issues. You know, this price, you know, keeping a high price through prolonged patents on medications, how is that a security issue? You know, how is a certain kinds of intellectual property rights a security issue? How is the ability to regulate food imports or exports for quality and safety and health, you know, a security issue? So, you know, there's an overreaching here that is highly, highly problematic. You know, and I just want to clarify that secrecy question, because I think it confuses a lot of people, a lot of the, you know, the general public. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think actually Congressman Alan Grayson had some good words to say about this. And it should be noted that the level of access that Congress now enjoys is recent. That's because members of Congress have raised a stink. Alan Grayson started public petitions demanding his right as a member of Congress to gain access to these documents, and only then was he granted the level of access that they even have now. And so these are just a few words that he had to say on his reaction to finally getting to see these documents. He said, "This more than anything shows the abuse of the classified information system. What I saw was nothing that could possibly justify the secrecy that surrounds it. It is ironic in a way that the government thinks it's all right to have a record of every single call that an American makes, but not all right for an American citizen to know what sovereign powers the government is negotiating away. Having seen what I've seen, I would characterize this as a gross abrogation of American sovereignty, and I would further characterize it as a punch in the face to the middle class of America. I think that's fair to say from what I've seen so far, but I'm not allowed to tell you why." And as for the argument that, well, now Congress has all this great access to this, you know, the issues around lack of access are in the past, this is a direct quote from a letter signed by 31 members of the House to President Obama, released on April 24th. So we're talking 5 days ago. And this is regarding the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership negotiations. Finally, given that, this is the quote, finally, given that these negotiations will focus mainly on a broad array of behind-the-borders regulatory policies and processes, a new standard of transparency and inclusiveness is required. Many of us have expressed concerns that we and our staff have difficulty gaining meaningful access to draft texts regarding this and other trade negotiations. Trade policies increasingly touch on policies that affect every American's daily life, and it is essential that the public and policymakers have ample time to review proposed texts and provide meaningful input before negotiations are finalized. So that's from 5 days ago. Now, who doesn't have these restricted access problems are the 600 roughly negotiators who have insider access as part of the industry trade advisory committees that were set up to advise the negotiating teams. And these are mostly, about over 500 of them, representatives of corporations and industry lobby groups who have this inside track so that they can influence the negotiations on behalf of their narrow corporate interests. So there are different advisory committees set up for different industries, and then the industries get to call the shots on what rules they want in these trade agreements, and are basically able to turn them into a smorgasbord of language that it just advances corporate interest. Now, you can't even say it's a rush towards deregulation, because in some cases they want less regulation, in other cases they want more. But what's consistent is they want rules that benefit them and their specific interests, not rules that benefit the public overall. They want less environmental rules, but more intellectual property rules governing mm-hmm. access to medicines, governing access to creative content. They want to regulate our daily use of the Internet and turn our Internet service providers into Internet cops, monitoring our Internet use so that we can face criminal penalties for everyday Internet use. So this isn't even one of the reasons I think that we see that both conservatives and liberals are against these agreements is that this is not just a push towards a deregulation agenda. This is a push towards government by the corporations, for the corporations, regulating or deregulating in where they want it for their interest. There's no sort of governing deregulation ideology here overall. It's just give the corporations what they want, that they've paid for through their access to the political system by bribing politicians.
Yeah, that's a tall order of business, which makes these treaties and their passage something that impacts countless different arenas in life and represents a real sea change in American politics. And one of the things, and governance, and global governance, in fact, one of the things that I realized, which is just kind of more intuitive than factual, is that the negotiations for these treaties began the very same year that the Citizens United ruling passed through the legal system and changed the amount of financial contribution that corporations and private entities could make in secrecy to the political campaigns of elected officials and thereby influence Congress. I mean, we've seen what 5 years of that has looked like. It's been a real sea change. A lot of people would like a constitutional amendment or in other ways to turn back the clock on that. Totally understandable. We've had people representing such organizations on this program. But the thing is, it's really, as we've discovered with this, you can do a lot of damage when you've already breached the integrity of a system, and it's really hard and becomes more challenging all the time to call it back. And that's why, having learned that lesson, here we are. They began negotiating these treaties during the same time frame that Citizens United passed, and now this is like the next step in the wrong direction, taking a bigger leap. And so I think that's also a reason why so many people have reacted to the treaties and recognized them as a primordial issue. And thankfully, interestingly, we know that many elected officials who were on the side of the angels in various issues have been defeated by this influx of private money, and there are many who are in office who are run and managed by those who have supported their election. There are others, many more, who, you know, still possess some independence and integrity, even though they have to compromise with this contaminated political environment, and are really, you know, stepping up at this time and identifying the holes and the gaps and the problems in all of this. Let's take a step back now, Adam, if we can, and talk a little bit about the economics, specifically the economic side of this, because this very week, and you know, when Monday morning hit, those of us who were watching this very closely were wondering how soon this debate would move in for a vote. And you know, and yet there hasn't been any direct forward movement. The Premier of Japan is visiting our country and will speak to the legislature, the you know, federal legislature. You can maybe tell us a little bit more about that. And of course, the implication is, you know, that he'll be there to kind to say, you know, sign off on this so we can move forward, and gee, we're so excited. I mean, I'd be surprised if he, you know, doesn't say something of that nature. I mean, I think that must be the reason for this groundbreaking and unprecedented visit. I'd like to hear more of your thoughts on that. But, you know, that has raised also the specter of China. One of the primary talking points about the treaties have been, if we don't sign these treaties, you know, if we don't fast-track this treaty, then we're going to be, you know, the U.S. economy is going to be in a disadvantageous position vis-a-vis China. And this is, you know, worrying a lot of people and, you know, driving them toward kind of going, well, maybe we do need these treaties, you know, gulp, we'll swallow and take the medicine. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, we've heard this song before. The idea that, well, we need to create international rules and then bring China in so that China can be made to be a good player in the international system economically, and we can get some control over China so long as we bring China in and have this framework for China to come into. We heard that exact argument in the late 90s. That was the argument that was used to justify permanent normalization of trade relations with China in order to facilitate Chinese accession into the World Trade Organization. That was the thing that was supposed to have this great effect of creating U.S. jobs and balancing our trade deficit with China, and that President Clinton sold as the way that we were going to deal with this hand-wringing around China. Well, that had the result of costing the U.S. 2.8 million jobs. In the time since that, this great fix, we've seen our trade deficit with China increase, not decrease. We've seen job losses as a result, not job gains. So part of President Obama's spin now about, well, people are looking to the past and thinking about, you know, and looking at past trade agreements. Well, this one's going to be different. I mean, that's a lot of where the spin is coming from, is because when these same promises have been made before, we've seen these are the effects that we've seen. NAFTA was promised as a job creator. NAFTA was promised as an agreement that would create prosperity, and did just the opposite. A million U.S. jobs were lost under NAFTA. Something like over 4 million Mexican farm jobs were lost as a result of NAFTA, leading to, first of all, freeing up workers to be exploited in factories that were moved south of the border under NAFTA, and second of all, forcing people to leave their land and their families and risk their lives to cross the border into the U.S. where they could be exploited north of the border for the benefit of corporations. And as a matter of survival, because they could no longer survive in their communities. So when President Obama talks about, well, we shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't be looking to the past, and we should think about we should look at the current agreement on its own terms rather than just sort of fighting past battles. These are the kind of battles he's talking about. But the reality is, we have no reason to think that TPP will be any different than these past agreements in terms of having unfulfilled promises, in terms of making things worse instead of better. And we don't have to look as far back as China PNTR or as NAFTA to see that. We can look at the agreements that President Obama himself negotiated or that he pushed into law. President Bush negotiated three trade agreements that were left over at the end of his term. Those are the agreements with Panama, South Korea, and Colombia. The Korea agreement was the biggest of those three agreements. The Economic Policy Institute warned that that agreement was going to cost the U.S. 159,000 jobs. The U.S. International Trade Commission warned that in New York State alone, over 147,000 U.S. jobs would be lost. And the Korea trade agreement, sure enough, has increased our trade deficit with South Korea and has cost the U.S. tens of thousands of jobs in the 3 years since it's been in effect. So when President Obama says that we should trust him on trade, we can only go on his own record. President Obama has not been smart in terms of trade negotiation and in terms of the trade agreements that he backed. It should be noted, by the way, that the Korea trade deal and the Colombia trade deal were agreements that President Obama explicitly opposed as a candidate for president and then flip-flopped as once he was actually elected to office. He applied little band-aids to the agreement. So with Colombia as a candidate, he decried how the human rights situation in Colombia, which is the worst human rights record in the Western Hemisphere, largest rate of internal displacement, and the highest rate of unionist killings in the world. And so he talked about how it would be unconscionable to sign a trade agreement with this nation without addressing these human rights issues. So as president, he applied this little tiny band-aid of a labor action plan to address some of the labor issues in Colombia, which pretty much everyone said at the time would be grossly insufficient to actually deal with the broad spectrum of human rights concerns in Colombia, let alone even just the labor concerns. And with Korea, he kind of bought off narrow sectors of business and labor by getting more access for U.S. automobiles. He actually, for a president who talks about climate change, one of the things that he actually got South Korea to agree to was to admit U.S. cars that did not meet Korean CAFE standards. So meaning less fuel-efficient cars would be going into South Korea. He also got Korea to agree to accept more U.S. beef. And so these are the industries that were going to benefit so that he could say that there were U.S. benefits to the agreement. But overall, for just about everyone else, this agreement was the same terrible agreement that it had always been, an agreement that was that had language in it that attacked rules on banking regulation, an agreement that everyone who was paying attention knew would increase the U.S. trade deficit and cost jobs. But these are the kind of band-aids President Obama used to justify completely reversing himself and pushing agreements that he campaigned as an opponent of. So when President Obama comes at us with this sort of Joe Isuzu routine and says, you know, you don't know what's in the agreement, but trust me, and we're supposed to grant him fast-track authority so that he can railroad these agreements through Congress without Congress even first knowing what it is that they're going to be voting on, we have no reason to trust him. We have no reason to trust him because of his own record. He, as a candidate, railed against Hillary Clinton because of NAFTA, because of her husband's support of NAFTA. And it was revealed that during the 2008 primaries, while he was campaigning in Ohio and condemning Senator Clinton for her support of NAFTA, or her husband's support of NAFTA, one of his advisors, his economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, was in Canada assuring the Canadian Prime Minister that he had no intention of actually fulfilling these campaign pledges. And that was actually leaked, and that hurt him in the primaries. And then once the primaries ended and he had the nomination, he was actually quoted in an interview saying that his rhetoric on NAFTA during the campaign, which was very strong, he talked about using the hammer of a potential opt-out to bring Canada and Mexico to the negotiating table to eke out a revised NAFTA that would be better for U.S. workers and the environment. But after the primary, he talked about that kind of language as overheated campaign rhetoric. That's a direct quote. So, quite frankly, we have a history of being lied to by this president about trade. We have a history of him breaking his promises. We have a history of him showing no qualms about saying one thing and doing exactly the opposite, rather. And so we have every reason to not trust him and to not want to grant him expanded authority because he abuses it time and again when it comes to trade. Our first sign that this president was not on the side of the public interest or human rights or the environment on trade goes all the way back to 2007, when as a candidate in the Democratic primaries, he was only one of two of the nine Democratic candidates at that point who supported the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. This is an agreement that groups like the Washington Office on Latin America and the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch were warning would increase violence and instability in the region and would also expand the Peruvian cocaine trade. Well, candidate Obama ignored those warnings, unlike, as did Senator Clinton, incidentally, unlike the seven other Democrats, people like John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich and even Joe Biden and Chris Dodd, who recognized that this agreement was a bad idea. So these two supported this agreement, and, well, we may as well have had a crystal ball, because pretty much, unfortunately, tragically, everything we said came true. In 2008, there was an uprising of Peruvian farmers who went on national strike complaining that the new market access for U.S. agricultural commodities, our subsidized industrially produced genetically modified agricultural commodities, would force Peruvian farmers out of the market. So the Peruvian farmers had a strike, and that led to the president declaring a state of emergency in which four farmers were killed. A year later, the president of Peru, President Alan Garcia, used the trade agreement to attack human rights when he issued a legislative decree, essentially using the trade agreement as a pretext to confiscate indigenous lands, to change the negotiating process around indigenous land use, the decision-making process around indigenous land use, so that he could turn over the lands of indigenous people to extractive industries and corporate agriculture and logging interests. So the indigenous people rose up, and the president declared a state of emergency, and that led to the Bagua massacre, which has been described as the Amazon Tiananmen Square, in which indigenous people were massacred for defending their land rights. And we had every reason to think that this is the sort of thing that would happen. This is a president who had described considering indigenous people's desire to not exploit natural resources as like listening to, like not going into an orchard and enjoying the fruits of that orchard because of a barking dog. Because he said the indigenous people don't intend to use these resources, so they have no right to them. And he also said that environmentalists are like watermelons, green on the outside and red on the inside. So this is the sort of government that that President Obama supported passing a free trade agreement with.
Let me just interject here because we're coming down to the last 10 minutes of the show, and I wanted to make sure that we cover one thing that's really come up and is in everyone's mind. A number of the senators, including Charles Schumer of New York and others, are really concerned that for one thing, as you've mentioned, the way that the outcome of these agreements are calculated, there have been some funny numbers. So on the one hand, someone will look at and focus in on one particular group of numbers and say, yay, hooray, we increase these numbers. But then on the other hand, they're not looking at the whole picture, which is a big net loss, which is what everybody else has been complaining about and describing. But one of the things in some of the literature that I've read from some of the economists who are critiquing this is a concern that because of the failure of the treaty to include any way of putting a lid on or controlling currency manipulation, any possible gains that we could be getting from signing these treaties will be completely undermined by currency manipulation. Now, this is something that I'm not, and so it'll wind up being a dead loss. No matter how much this is tweaked or it's made a little better here and there, many argue it's a loss to begin with based on past treaties, as you've been telling us. But even just from this one perspective that it won't be including a control for currency manipulations, and there's nothing about that in these treaties, there are many who are concerned that alone will end up being a major net loss to the United States, our jobs, our economy, our people. Can you describe or kind of inform our listeners of why currency manipulation is such a hot-button issue right now?
Yes. So one of the things that President Obama has done to sell TPP is cite Peterson Institute numbers. This is specifically the Peterson Institute for International Economics. During his State of the Union address, he was talking about how the Peterson Institute numbers suggested that TPP would create over 500,000 new U.S. jobs. Well, the Washington Post actually looked at those numbers, and the Washington Post is no enemy of free trade, to say the least, but even they had to admit in their sort of, factual statements rating that President Obama deserved 4 Pinocchio noses for that quote, because in reality, Peterson Institute data suggested that the agreement would create 0 new jobs. And if President Obama had actually been reading what the Peterson Institute was putting out, he would be aware that Peterson Institute research suggests that the U.S. trade deficit the role of currency manipulation in the U.S. trade deficit could account for between $200 billion and $500 billion, so somewhere between a little less than to nearly all of the U.S. trade deficit. So the issue of currency manipulation.
What is currency manipulation? Can you explain that to listeners who are completely unfamiliar with this?
Yeah.
What is currency manipulation?
And I'm actually going to quote here directly from an article in The Week. Currency manipulation is when governments engage in policies that drive down the value of their currency relative to other currencies. And lately, other currencies has usually meant the U.S. dollar. This makes our exports more expensive and their imports cheaper, which drives up the U.S. trade deficit. In practical terms, this means that demand, which could be staying in the U.S. and creating jobs, is instead leaving to create jobs in other countries' economies. At the moment, the trade deficit is somewhere in the vicinity of $500 billion, which amounts to about 3% of the economy just getting sucked up into the ether every year. That costs American jobs, but because the jobs lost are disproportionately in exporting industries like manufacturing, and because a high-value dollar helps low-wage employers like Walmart that have invested in low-cost foreign supply chains, the trade deficit also drives down wages, speeding up the hourglass effect in which our economy produces lots of high-paying and low-paying jobs, but fewer and fewer middle-income jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So many in Congress said that this is really, that TPP will have no real value if this issue is not addressed in terms of countries like Japan and, yes, China, where And so for many members of Congress, particularly many Democrats, this is a make-or-break issue in terms of their support for TPP. As you mentioned, Senator Schumer has been very vocal on this issue. This has really become a wedge issue in terms of support for this agreement. If we really to have a TPP that doesn't address this issue, as they see it, would be really a pointless agreement, that we're not getting at the heart of what we're not getting at the heart. If we're talking about using these agreements to fix problems and to address job losses and to address our trade deficit, this is an absolutely essential issue that needs to be addressed. And time and again, when representatives of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, like U.S. Trade Rep Michael Froman, have been questioned on this issue by Congress, they've stonewalled. They've shown really no interest in including this kind of language in TPP, probably because they couldn't get a TPP passed that included it. It's unlikely that Japan would agree to a TPP that had these currency provisions. And if the long-term goal is to bring China into this agreement, it's pretty unlikely that China would agree to that either. So the passage of TPP is contingent on leaving out the only language that could actually make it useful in terms of what many of our elected officials see as the key fix to the problems that TPP is supposed to fix. So while TPP isn't going to address job losses or the U.S. trade deficit, it's going to, and even though that's how it's being sold, it's going to do all these other things for corporations. That is really what it's about, expanding corporate intellectual property rights, expanding corporate investor rights. It's not about creating jobs. It never has been about creating jobs. It's about expanding corporate power. And the failure of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative to aggressively push currency manipulation, or really at all to push currency manipulation as part of this agreement, really gives the lie to the idea that this agreement is about what President Obama is selling it on.
Mm-hmm. Given what you're describing and what we're seeing, which is the opposition coming from many different quarters, it's coming from many Democrats, it's coming even from the right, you know, who is in favor of it? And do they have the votes to pass it?
Well, President Obama obviously loves it. His new best friend, Paul Ryan, who is such a great buddy of Obama now that he's joking about how he is in the House Ways and Means Committee shooting down Democratic amendments and proposed Democratic legislation on behalf of pushing the bill that that Obama wants delivered. They think it's a great idea. There are a few corporate Democrats like Gregory Meeks of New York, who is also, incidentally, perhaps not coincidentally, rated year after year by the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington as one of the 10 most corrupt people in Congress. He thinks it's a great idea. There are a bunch of mainstream Republicans, including the leadership in both houses, who are supporting this agreement. So Mitch McConnell and John Boehner want it. On the other hand, there are many Tea Party Republicans who, unfortunately, not as many as we'd like, but certainly many who are speaking out against this, at least at the very least against fast-track authority, who some of whom have concerns about TPP overall, but many of whom at the very least just think the idea of delegating more authority to President Obama after just being elected on a campaign focusing on how the president is taking too much power is not such a good idea. And for many of them, it's not just an issue of politics, but it's also an issue of constitutional principle. They recognize that fast-track authority, while maybe strictly speaking within the letter of the Constitution, because in theory Congress can choose to delegate some of its authority, is certainly going against the spirit of separation of powers. And they want Congress to maintain that power, and they want the Constitution to be practiced as it's intended, and so they believe Congress should not give up this power, and so there are many of them really are concerned about TPP itself, the attack on national sovereignty represented by these international trade tribunals that have the power to declare our laws to be in violation of the rights of foreign corporations. So for many on the right, these are big concerns. And groups on the right, in the grassroots of the right, are organizing on this issue. Groups like the Eagle Forum and Americans for Limited Government. There's a campaign called End Global Governance by some important voices on the right. Groups far out on the right, like the John Birch Society, have been speaking out. More mainstream Republicans, even some more moderate Republicans, people like New York's Chris Gibson, have raised real concerns about fast track.
I just want to interject here because we're coming down to our last minute. You know, this has been a terrific update, and so you know the takeaway is this is still in play. The outcome is unknown. There are a lot of people who have concerns, a spectrum of concerns, as Adam Weissman has discussed with us today on this show. So if you're listening and you'd like to participate, because we need your help in assuring that we get a no on fast track vote coming up in our Congress, you can go to www.stopfasttrack.com and just by entering your phone number and they'll call and get your zip code and they'll immediately connect you to your representatives and senators so you can ask them to vote no on fast track. You know, if that happens, we'll have the time to slow down, really look what these treaties are about, look into their contents. The point is they're being rushed through in secret with many, many problems such as Adam Weissman has kindly detailed on today's show, and you can help assure they don't pass. Stay tuned, listeners. Next week, we'll be back with another Connect the Dots tracking this issue. Thank you so much for being with us again, Adam Weissman of Global, of Trade Justice New York Metro, and your organizing has really been superb, and you're a knowledgeable, reporter and witness on this issue. Thank you so much for being with us again. There was me.